Lord Jesus, I thank you that you have extended the call. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. You said, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I'm meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Father, there are burdens that we carry. Some are physical, some are emotional, some are financial, some are relational, some are spiritual. There's a load that we should carry, but there are burdens that we should not. We should learn to lay them down. We should learn to give them to you. And we thank you that your shoulders are broad. In fact, the government of the world is on your shoulders. You run it. And so, Father, now in the silence, we want to give you that which weighs us down, that which keeps us from looking up to you. Lord Jesus, you said that your yoke is easy and your burden is light. Show us how to carry that one, the one that you have for us, and walk in rest and peace, even amidst the turmoil, even amidst the storms. We have spoken to you through song. We ask now that you would speak to us through your word. Speak to each one of us. And then may we have the ears to hear and the wills to follow. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. We're in the book of Job. So if you would turn there, that's if you go to the middle of your Bible and then go a little bit left, you'll hit Job. We're studying this book and the subject of suffering, and we're doing so because we are all going to suffer to one degree or another. For some of us, it will only be the drip, drip, drip suffering of living in a world that doesn't function in the way that God designed. Okay, that's something that every one of us will experience. Others of us will experience traumatic suffering. Things that have the capability of destroying us emotionally, destroying us spiritually. They can be relational troubles within families or friends. It can be in the workplace. It can be really emotional struggles and suffering, burdens that just weigh us down, our inability to handle what we're going through. They can be physical pain and suffering that's almost beyond what we're able to bear. And then it can be spiritual. It can be coming in from Satan's spiritual oppression that way, or it can be just the feelings of abandonment by God. And what makes this book so relevant is that is what Job was going through. He, as a normal human, he had the drip, 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 but then he got hit with some very terrible things in all of those four areas. And we saw that Job, above everyone else in the world, should not have gone through what he went through. If we read this book and understand it, we would think Job is not someone who should be experiencing what he's experiencing. And what that does for us is that when we are righteous, when we are experiencing things that we should not experience, it's not brought upon us because of our own stupidity or because of our own sin, but when we begin to suffer as righteous people, this book will help us. Okay, and what we have seen is that as we were introduced to Job in chapters 1 and 2 as a righteous man, none more righteous than Job, or a godly man, the man who God says is blameless. and upright. He fears God, meaning he takes God very, very seriously, and he avoids evil to a degree that no one else did. I won't read to you a lot of verses, but let me just read a little bit. This is from chapter 29, in which a lot of you all are concerned with social justice, right? Job was one who was concerned with social justice. Chapter 29, he said, "I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I searched out the cause of him I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous, and I made him drop his prey from his teeth." Concerning sexual purity, he said, "I have made a," this is chapter 21, "I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze upon a virgin? What would my portion be from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? If my heart had been enticed towards a woman and I had lain in wait by my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down on her. For that would have been a heinous crime. That would have been iniquity to be punished by the judges. For that would be the fire that consumes as far as Abaddon, and it would consume to the root all my increase." Okay, so there was sexual purity. He said, if I have walked with falsehood and my feet had hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If I have withheld anything from the poor desire, caused the eyes of the widow to fall, or have eaten my morsel alone and the fatherless has not eaten of it. He said, I've taken care of the people that are in need. He said, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless because I saw my help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder and let my arm be broken from its socket. If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me or exalted when evil overtook him, if I have concealed my transgression as others do and by my hiding my iniquity, because I stood in great fear of the multitude and the contempt of the families terrified me. If I have kept silence and did not go outdoors, meaning if I didn't hang around other people, because he was an extremely wealthy man. If my land has cried out against me, if I've abused my land and did not fertilize it or let it sit and rest. If I've eaten its yield without payment and made its landowners breathe their last, then let thorns grow instead of wheat and foul weeds instead of barley. If I've made gold my trust or called my fine gold my confidence, if I've rejoiced because my wealth was abundant because my hand had found much, if I have looked at the sun when it shone or the moon moving in its splendor, meaning if I've worshipped the sun or the moon, then let me be condemned. Job is saying, you can examine my life and you will not find anything wrong. I have not abused those who work for me. I have taken care of the poor. I have not abused my land or my crop or my animals. I have not rejoiced when my enemies have fallen. Job was a righteous man. And he was a blessed man. We saw that he was the wealthiest man of his day in the era of the world in which he lived. He was a man who people greatly respected. Okay, so he was not just wealthy, he was looked up to. Let me read a few verses that speak of that. He said, "When I went to the city gate, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew. The aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The voice of the nobles hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. Men listened to me, and they waited and kept silent for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for rain, and they opened their mouths as for a spring rain. I chose their way, and sat as chief. I live like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. Okay. A great man. And then we saw God took a hedge away from Job. He had put a hedge around him, and then he parted the hedge and let Satan attack. Satan had come, and he had reported into God. Evidently, that's what he has to do periodically. He has to give an account of what he's been doing. And God calls his attention, and he says, when you were out roaming to and fro across the face of the earth, did you see my servant Job? And he said, yeah, I did. And God said, there's none like him in all the world. And he said, of course there's not. You've blessed him. You've hedged him. You won't let me touch him. But if you part the way, he will curse you to your face. And God says, no, he won't. You can have him. Just don't touch his flesh. Do whatever else you want. And so Satan attacks, and we saw that he lost everything he had. He lost his wealth. He lost his ability to make wealth. He lost his servants, and then his children were killed. And all this was reported back to him one after another in the same day, same moment. He learns he loses everything. And in great grief, he stands up. He tears his clothes. He shaves his head, and he falls on the ground, and he worships. Satan comes back again, reports into God. Same conversation ensues. He says, yeah, but if you let me touch him, he will curse you to his face. And God says, you can have your way with him. And so Satan attacks, and he afflicts him with sores, oozing sores from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. Okay, that's what's happened to the most righteous man. He is suffering. As he's lost everything that he has, he's lost his health, then he becomes a social pariah, an outcast. Let me read from Job 30, trying to set the stage. Okay, remember, he was one who lived like a king among his troops. It says, but now... This is verse number 1 of chapter 30. But now I am mocked by people younger than I, by young men whose fathers are not worthy to run with my sheepdogs. A lot of good they are to me, those worn out wretches. And then he describes them. He says, they are gaunt with hunger and flee to the deserts. They to desolate and gloomy wastelands. They pluck wild greens from among the bushes and eat the roots of the broom trees. They are driven from human society, and people shout at them as if they were thieves. And so now they are living in frightening ravines and caves and among the rocks. They sound like animals howling among the bushes, huddled together beneath the nettles. They are nameless fools, outcast from society. Okay, he's talking about these people are the scum of the earth. Total outcast. And then he says, and now, this is verse number 9, and now they mock me with vulgar songs. They taunt me. They despise me and won't come near me except to spit in my face. For God has cut my bowstring. He has humbled me. So they have thrown off all restraint. These outcasts oppose me to my face. They send me sprawling and lay traps in my path. They block my road and do everything they can to destroy me. They know I have no one to help me. They come at me from all directions. They jump on me when I am down. I live in terror now. My honor has blown away with the wind. Now, think how much your view of yourself is contingent upon other people's view of you. You know, most of us think, well, no, I don't depend upon what they think of me. I think about me, about how I am in Jesus, right? Wrong. Every one of us, I'll guarantee it, this morning, looked into our closets or into our drawers and selected what we thought went well together so that somebody would either like what I was looking like, what I was wearing and how I fixed my hair, or they wouldn't laugh at me the way in which I am looking. Right? Every one of us, if we were if it was just us in the world and we got up, would we spend the time combing our hair and maybe ironing something, trying to make something sure that something was color coordinated? And you think, well, Carter, you didn't do that. I tried. No, we would not do it. How many of you this month have maybe given something away that you thought was no longer in style? Perfectly good clothes, but the styles wasn't quite right. And I learned this month, no, this is February, I learned last month that pleats were out. But I am not getting rid of my pants. Okay, we get rid of shoes that are still very wearable, but the colors are not quite right. You know, if the lapels are too narrow or too wide, if you got shoulder pads, we know that those are way out. You throw those things away. Why? Because you care about what other people think about you. Our whole self-image is tied up in what other people feel and think about us. If they laugh at our jokes, then we feel good. If we tell a joke and it falls flat, we're so embarrassed. Okay. Now, that's where we all are to one degree or another. It's what we drive, what we wear, a lot of times where we go, what we do. Job was at the very, very top, and everybody in almost worshiped him. Everybody hung on his very words. And when he spoke on an issue, everybody else was silent. There was nothing else to add. Extremely wealthy, very well respected, praised by man and by God. And then he loses it all. Nobody wants to be around him. And the lowest of the low are mocking him. Now, in times where people seem to turn against you and don't like you or don't want to be around you or don't think you're funny or don't think you're smart, isn't it nice to be able to go home where you're loved and accepted? Is that nice? Yeah, it is. It's nice. Job goes home, but he doesn't go home to a place where he is loved and accepted. He goes home and his children are dead. He goes home to his wife where there ought to be safety. There ought to be comfort. There ought to be love. There ought to be acceptance. That's what there should be. But that's not what he's met with. If you'll look at chapter 2. In verse number 9. His wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." When he goes home, what does he get? He gets disgust. How long are you going to hold on to your integrity? And she takes the sword and sticks it in. What's her solution to his pain? Just die. Curse God and die. That's her solution for what he's going through. Be the kind of man that Satan says you will be. That's the whole thing. Satan says that if you take away everything he has, he will stop serving you. He will not love you. He will not follow you. He will curse you. And she's saying, be the kind of man that Satan says you are. Curse God and die. Did he do it? No. He says to verse number 10, "But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women would speak.'" didn't even call her a fool. Just, you speak like a foolish woman. Shall we receive good from God? And shall we not receive evil or bad things, disaster? In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, we saw several weeks ago that what suffering does and what pain does is it exposes to us what we put our confidence in. Okay. What is it that we find meaning? What is it that gives us significance? What is it that gives us, you know, stabilizes us? Suffering does not rob us of our joy. What does? Idolatry. Idols do. Okay. When we lose something or someone, if it causes us to go into a deep depression from which we cannot come out, if it causes us, if we lose something or have something take away, and it causes us to become angry and embittered, what we are saying is, I need that thing in order to have joy. I need that person or that something in order to be complete. God is not enough for me. I need God plus. And that plus thing is the idol. Job lost everything. He lost his kids. He lost his wealth. He lost the respect of the community. He lost support from his wife. He lost it all. Everything that a person could look to for that meaning and significance and security, for as a source of joy and happiness. He lost it all, but he didn't crack. He worshiped. If God is our source, when everything else is taken away, if we lose something, what that will do is that will drive us into deeper into our source. That's what it did for Job. It drove him deeper into God. If it drives us away from God, towards that cursing God, then we know it's touching on something that is too valuable to us. And I think that we each have these mini Job situations in life where it's not actually Satan saying to God, where most of us are not, none of us are big enough to be really picked on by Satan himself. However, there are these little situations in which God allows things in our life to be touched. It can be relationships, it can be possessions, it can be just the respect that we feel like we deserve and we need. And we lose those things. And in those times, we have the opportunity to show to the world and to the watching angels how valuable God is to us. I think that this takes place all the time in many situations. Many, M-I-N-I, many situations where there is the test, what do I value? If it is taken away, will he still praise you, God? I don't think he'll still praise you. And God says, go ahead, take it, and I'll show you. And so when we pass the test, what we do is we proclaim to the angels, we proclaim to the people that are watching us that I value God above that thing that I lost. And that's significant. That happens in the drip, drip, drip times, and that happens in the major trauma times. Now, this is kind of a little side note. Mrs. Job, I don't know what her name is. Mrs. Job is oftentimes, I'll say all the time, picked on by people, right? And rightly so. She should be picked on by people because she sinned against Job. And hopefully she apologized. Hopefully she repented of what she did. However, and she should have been an encouragement, but she was a real thorn and she tempted him to sin. However, we've got to understand how much she was suffering. Okay. She too lost her children. Okay. So she is heartbroken. She is devastated. Okay. We've got to understand that. Everything through that grid. She lost her children. She lost her standing in the community. Okay, her husband was the big man. She's right with him. And when he's demoted to the lowest of the low, she goes down there with him. She lost all of her wealth. Okay, so she loses everything. The only thing she did not lose was her health. But she watched the man whom she loved suffer. Okay, and so she sees the pain that he's in. And that affects her. So yes, she ought to be criticized. However, we need to understand that her great pain and cut her just a little bit of slack. Now, this was not just local news that what happened to Job. Job was very famous, and the news of his suffering, what he had experienced, traveled very far. And now we, in verses 11 through 13 of chapter 2, we're introduced to the characters that form out the rest of the book. Job's three friends. Now when Job's three friends heard about all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamite. Oh, this second guy, Bildad, he's one of the smallest people in the book, Bible. You got Nehemiah, and then there's Bildad the Shuhite. He was. Okay, you all got that? Okay. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and to comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Okay, we don't know really anything else about these men except for what we're told here, and then some of the insight that we can get of them as you read how they interacted with Job. These men evidently were, as I said, they were three of his friends. They are not local. Okay, they are from different villages, different towns, different cities, different parts of that world. They were probably very wealthy businessmen. Because they were peers with Job. They were godly men. These were believers. Okay, this book was written, it's the oldest book in the Bible. This predates Abraham. And these men have come to know what we say is the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They knew God. And they have heard about Job's suffering. And they have communicated with each other, let's go and be with Job. And so they come, they make their way, and then as they are coming, they see Job, and so and they don't recognize him because of what these sores have done to him. And I mentioned before, it's described as they're oozing sores, they have become infested with worms. His skin is blackened, and the only relief he can get is taking a broken piece of pottery and scraping. Okay. He's probably sitting outside the city. If not, it's in his own the garbage heap from his own house. And when they see him from far away, they don't recognize him. And then they come close, and they, in a sense, they're overcome. And it says that their response is that they weep. They are overcome with emotion. They weep for him. They weep with him. This is not just a little sobbing. This is big. And then they sit down with him. And they sit with him for 7 days in silence. They raised their voices and wept. They tore their robes, sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And then they sit on the ground, and no one speaks a word, for they saw that his suffering was very great. This type of grief, this type of identification is basically what you do for the dead. He was in such bad shape as though he was dead. And so Job is really basically attending his own funeral here. Job's friends, like Job's wife, catch a lot of grief. And rightly so. As we'll see when we get to the end of the book, they get a lot of grief from God. So much so that Job is going, for them to basically get forgiveness and maybe live, Job is going to have to come in and offer sacrifices for them and pray for them. Okay, so they cross the line in this book. However, and as we'll see there, one of them is so insensitive, just to give you a little bit of clue, one of them is so insensitive that he blames Job for his own children's death. Okay, Job, the reason why your children are dead is it's your fault. Okay, they really cross the line. They're very insensitive. But before we go there, I think we need to understand how good friends these guys are. These are really good friends. And they came here at great expense to themselves. What they did here is very, very costly. Cost them a lot of time, cost them a lot of money, and it cost them a lot of effort, and it cost them a lot of emotional pain. Okay. Okay, these men are from another part of the country or that area. Okay, a Naamanite, a Shuhite, and Ezra, I can't remember what. Okay, so these are different. These are people different from different areas. They have heard that Job has really gone through the ringer. Okay, news has had to travel. Okay, to wherever they are, and then he's got to have fallen apart, not only financially but also physically here to be where he is. Okay. They somehow hear, and then they communicate with each other. Let's go see Job. Now, for them to get from wherever they are to wherever Job is not like for us going to Chattanooga. Maybe the distance was as far as Chattanooga, maybe it was further. They would have to travel by foot or by animal. Okay, that's going to take a while. And then they come, and then they sit. And they sit for 7 days. Okay. What do you think is going on while they're sitting there? Back home. They're not working. They're not earning a living. They're having to take time off from their ability to make money, their ability to provide for their own. They have to leave family and friends and come and travel a great distance and be there for at least a week. Okay, so this is a lot of effort to travel a far distance back then. It's a lot of time, the travel time to and fro, the sitting time. So they're taking a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of time off to come and spend with him. So they're losing time, they're losing money. And then they come in and it's at great emotional cost to themselves. They're around somebody who's not very pleasant to look at. And they weep. They enter in. Okay. So What kind of friends do you think these were? What kind of friend?
Very loyal.
Very loyal. Would you like to have friends like Job had? Ones who's willing at great cost to themselves to come and be beside you? One who would be willing just to sit with you as long as you needed? One who would not recoil from you in horror if you were really looking bad and smelling? One who would be willing to spend a whole lot of money just to be near you? I think they're great friends. Friends that we would all like to have. Through this experience, they created a safe place for Job. Because they came, because they sat, Job felt that they were very, very safe. And then Job begins to part the curtain into his own life. And he begins to let them inside. And begins to let them know what he's feeling, what he's thinking, what he's going through. And chapter 3 is what they learn when Job lets them in. After this, after the 7 days, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that was said, a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine on it. Let gloom and darkness claim it, deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter in. Let those who curse it, who curse the day, let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to help to rouse up the Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it have no hope for life, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes." What's he saying there? No, he hadn't gotten to "wish I was never born" yet. He wants that whole day wiped off the calendar. Okay, so I was born on October 28th, may that day be forever banished from the calendar. May there only go October 27th, October 29, may that day never be. Then he goes on and says, "Why did I not die at birth? Come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me? Or why did the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have laid down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with the princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasure, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to man, a man whose way is hidden from God, who has hedged it in? For my sign comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." This is a very dark chapter. Can you hear his pain? He said, why was I born? Why couldn't I have just been, in a sense, aborted? Why was there needs to receive me? Why didn't I just starve to death? Why didn't I die in the womb? Why am I allowed to live now? He says, the people that want to die can't die. And the people that want to live, they die. Why am I still alive? Job wants to die. He is in so much pain. And I think he probably thought about, but did not do it, probably thought about killing himself. He looks at his life and they said, there's nothing worth living for. The thing that I feared has happened. And I want to die. That's his pain. And some of you all have felt that. Some of you know exactly where Job is. He's inviting his friends in. The thing I think that he says, what he's grieving most, and we won't be able to develop this, is not so much that he lost all of his stuff. There's no, if you read through the rest of the book, he doesn't really grieve a lot of times for the stuff that he lost. That's not what's the thing that he says here. The thing that I fear, that's verse number 25, has come upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I think that's what it was being alluded to in verse number 23, where he says, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Okay, he feels that God has hedged him in. Okay. Satan has says, yeah, you hedged him in. You protect him from all the bad stuff. Now he's feeling God has hedged him in, and he's got all the bad stuff, and God won't let it out. God won't let him go. He's hedged in. Chapter 29, if you'll turn there. And again, Job again took up his discourse and said, oh, that I were as the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon me, was upon my tent, and the Almighty was yet with me. And when my children were all around me, and when my steps were washed with butter. And then he goes and he kind of talks about how good life was. But at the very top of it, he goes back, oh, for the days when God watched over me, and when the friendship of God was upon my tent, and when the Almighty was yet with me. And then in chapter 30, in verse number 11, says, God has loosed my cord, my bowstring, and humbled me. In verse number 9, and God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer. I stand, and you only look at me. The thing that he feared was that God would turn against him. That God would not be with him. Job has lost his peace. He's lost the presence of God. And it's devastating to him. Now, we'll see next week that Job's theology was that the one who is right with God, God will bless. And Job has been right with God. He's the most godly man on the face of the earth, and God blessed. And then when he lost all of his stuff, the thing that comes into his mind is, now God is against me. God was for me, now God's against me. What have I done? The thing that I fear most is that God is no longer with me. And it's now being evidenced in all this that I'm going through. What is it that we can learn from this? Let me give two things. Number one is, even though we might be righteous with God, righteous before God, and we might believe in the sovereignty of God and be a spiritual giant, we can be those things, be right with God. We can believe in the sovereignty of God, which we dealt with last week, and we can be a spiritual giant. Even if we're those things, it doesn't mean that we are immune to pain. It doesn't mean that we remain unbothered by negative circumstances and suffering and loss. Remember who Job is. And we need to understand that we can weep over circumstances. There is a time to laugh and there is a time to mourn. And it is wrong to laugh and when it's the time of mourning. It's wrong. In the time of mourning, we mourn, and it doesn't matter who we are. Trust and tears can exist side by side. We serve a God who weeps. Sometimes the most godly thing we can do is weep. Remember Jesus at Lazarus' tomb. Okay, Jesus is God. His friends, Mary and Martha, have suffered loss. They've lost their brother. He sees what they're going through. He sees the community in pain. And he weeps. Jesus in the garden, facing the cross, he weeps. He cries out. He's in great pain. He won't survive it unless the angels come and strengthen him. Okay. And then on the cross, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? So, no, it's okay. It doesn't matter who we are. You know, this response that Job has here is not always appropriate. Weeping is not always appropriate. Sometimes this extreme is reserved for the most difficult of cases. But if you are experiencing this, if you are experiencing maybe a time of God's silence, that's where Job was. God was silent. Where is God? I can't find him. He's lost his peace. If you are there, know that Jesus understands. Jesus has been there. From all eternity, the Godhead was one, unified. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, in community, in deep relationship, never separated. On the cross, there is the separation. On the cross, there was the turning away. On the cross, there was no more communion between the Son and the Father. There was, the silence. Jesus understands. Okay. There was the withdrawal from Jesus. There's not the withdrawal from us. We feel as though, but God really doesn't withdraw. Jesus went through that, the true withdrawal, so that we won't experience it. So he knows what you're feeling, so you can go to him, and he understands. The second thing we should get from this is that Job's friend created a safe space for Job. For Job to be honest, for Job to ventilate, for Job to lament. And I want us to be those kind of friends to each other. We need to be safe. We need to give people permission to expose themselves, to invite us in. Nobody should go through difficulty alone. Job's friends said, "We're safe," and invited, and Job invited them in. And that's what I want us to be. And what I'd like for us to do as kind of the final application is I want us to start that. And if you are in a situation, if you are going through something, if you are have suffered something and you're wrestling with it, you're in pain and you need prayer, I want us to pray for you. And so what I want to do is I want, if that's you, I want you to raise your hand, and I want the people that are around you to gather around you, and you can give them a little bit of insight of what's going on, and then people will pray for you. Okay. I want us to be a place that's safe. Now, if somebody shares something, don't you dare do what Job's friends did, what we're going to see next week. Don't you dare be Job's wife. Job's friends almost didn't survive their betrayal of Job. And there might not be a Job that will pray for you, that God will pardon you. So be safe. So let's have a time of prayer for each other. If you have a need, if you have somebody that would, you would like, if you want people to pray for you, I want you to raise your hand. And those that are around you, I want you to gather around them. I want you to pray. And then after a time, we'll sing. Emily will start "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," and we'll sing that together as people are wrapping up prayer. So let's go ahead. If you have a need and you want somebody to pray for you, raise your hand, and then people just gather around and pray for them. And that will be, we're moving towards the close. So if you have a need and you want somebody to pray for you, raise your hand, and if you don't, then we will just sing "What a Friend We Have." Okay, we've got one in the back. Okay, anybody else has we've got several. Okay, so raise your hand high and people will gather around you and pray for you, and then we'll sing. So let's pray.